Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Tonight's appearance by Mr. Kunitz is the first Martha Friedberg memorial reading the Poetry Center has sponsored. We thus inaugurate an event to be held every year in which, with an appearance by a writer of special distinction, we intend to honor the memory of one of our founders, Martha Friedberg, who died last January, and who left us a bequest which seems appropriate to use in this way, though it was also sufficient to commence what in effect will be an endowment for the center. I'm glad to note that members of Mrs. Friedberg's immediate family, including her husband, Dr. Stanton Friedberg, and her sons and daughters, Anne, Cass, John, and Kate, as well as her grandson, Dan, are here to help us mark the occasion. We like to think that Martha Friedberg would have been pleased to have an annual reading of this sort named for her, though we know that if she had lived to hear of it, she would have disallowed any such commemoration. This was not from ordinary modesty. She was a woman of strong and proud spirit, whose deprecation did not deceive those who knew her. But she believed poetry and the organization that served it were more important than herself, and she never wished it to be thought of as taking any personal role in advance of them. That she substantially supported the center for many years, that she was a good poet in her own right, were less to her than that poetry itself and good writing generally be heard in this city, as up to the time the center started, they had not been, and as they are now in large part through its auspices. Through her auspices, I would have said, except that I can see her shaking her head. The way to praise her was always not to seem to. Let it be in her honor, then, that, so far as possible, we think not of her, but of poems this evening, and on all future occasions such as this, when we recollect her presence among us. And let this be particularly the case in view of the fact that she herself, before she died, invited Mr. Kunitz to come and read his poems tonight. You can buy a book of these, incidentally, at the table up in the lobby after the reading, when Mr. Kunitz will sign them. But here to introduce Stanley Kunitz is Mark Perlberg. Please welcome him now.
Thank you very much, John. I wonder if those lights could be lowered a little bit. Stanley is a very warm and friendly man, and he'd like to see the audience, I bet. That's better. I can see you. It means a great deal to me to be introducing this particular reading, and not solely because Stanley Kunitz is one of our country's finest poets. That certainly would be reason enough, but because it was Martha Friedberg who proposed that the Poetry Center invite him to read for us in this, his 90th year. Further, Stanley was Martha's brother-in-law. He is married to her sister, the painter Elise Asher. Stanley and his poetry and his view of poetry and life meant a great deal to Martha. She would have introduced him tonight, and now I stand here in her stead. Stanley's honors include most of the awards that are given to our best poets. His selected poems won the Pulitzer Prize in 1959, His next book of poems, The Testing Tree, won enthusiastic praise from Robert Lowell and Theodore Rethke. Rethke, by the way, was a close friend of Stanley's, as was Lowell's, and Stanley served as a mentor for a time for Rethke. Kunitz was consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress. He received the Bolingen Award, and 2 years ago was presented with a National Medal for the Arts at the White House by President Clinton. Stanley Kunitz is a New Englander and a New Yorker. He was born in 1905 in Worcester, Mass. He's the author of numerous books of poems, two of which I've already mentioned, and of essays and translations. In the last category, I want to single out his translations with Max Heywood of Anna Akhmatova. To mark the beginning of his 10th decade, Norton has just published a new book, Passing Through, that John mentioned. It's subtitled The Later and New and Selected Poems. And you'll be able to buy that, as John said. And I'm happy to report that two things. Stanley will autograph them, number one, and two, even more important, it's been nominated for the National Book Award. Stanley is celebrated as a teacher and as a friend of the young, as well as a poet. A number of his former students have established solid reputations of their own and have announced their indebtedness to him. They include Mary Oliver, Greg Orr, Louise Gluck, Tess Gallagher, Michael Ryan, and Carolyn Forche, among others. I can cite a concrete example of his attention and concern for the work of young poets. When he served as judge for the Yale Younger Poets Prize, which is certainly a coveted award, and he did that for 6 years, he refused to have any readers screen the hundreds of manuscripts that were submitted. He insisted on reading all of them himself. Stanley began to publish with the generation that grew up in the shadow of what has been called the great modernists: Eliot, Pound, Stevens, Moore, Williams, and I suppose Cummings. From the publication of The Testing Tree in 1971, in book after book, he moved toward and achieved a poetry of great transparency, directness, of a kind of radiance. His poems are marked by passion and often by a profundity that only the best poets achieve. As he grapples with the pain and joy of life and its essential mystery, and as he has written, I am not done with my changes. It is a privilege to introduce to you one of the finest poets of our time, Stanley Kunitz, and I'm going to go backstage and bring him out.
Fortunately, I haven't heard anything that was said about me backstage. But I should like to say that as for that round number of years attributed to me, I prefer to think of it as one of my inventions, one of the figments of my imagination. Only a few days ago, on a return visit to my native city, I crossed the threshold of the house of my childhood and felt the years drop away from me. By the time I reached the guests assembled in the dining room to greet me, I was firmly persuaded that I was only 12 again, and not a day after. In the interval since then, I may have piled on a few more years, but I don't want to challenge the gods. by being more explicit. I recall that when Thomas Hardy, in his 88th year, completed the manuscript aptly titled Winter Words, he prepared in advance a preface for it in which he bragged a bit about his longevity. So far as I'm aware, he wrote, I happen to be the only English poet who has brought out a new volume of verse on his 89th birthday. Well, when that birthday arrived, Winter Words appeared on schedule, but Thomas Hardy happened not to be around. Isn't that a cautionary tale? In the introduction to my new collection, Passing Through, I assert that poetry is ultimately mythology, the telling of the stories of the soul, and admittedly, this might seem to be an introverted, even solipsistic enterprise, if it were not that these stories recount the soul's passage through the valley of this life. That is to say, its adventure in time, in history. A poem is solitary and on its way, wrote Paul Celan, the poet of the Holocaust. It is on its way, let me add, because it seeks a community. In the absence of a community, or without the hope of one, poetry withers. That's where you out there come in. Poets are always ready to talk about the difficulties of their art. On this occasion, I want to say something about its rewards and joys. The poem comes in the form of a blessing, like rapture breaking on the mind, as I tried to phrase it in my youth. Through the years, I have found this gift of poetry to be life-sustaining, life-enhancing, and absolutely unpredictable. You never know whether a new poem is possible. Does one live, therefore, for the sake of poetry? No, the reverse is true. Poetry is for the sake of the life. I want to dedicate this reading to the memory of Martha Friedberg, who, as you all know, as you have heard, is a founder and guiding spirit of this poetry center, and whom I count among my dearest friends. Greatly loved, greatly missed. I'm going to read poems from this new collection entitled Passing Through. And they'll be roughly in chronological order. this first poem goes back to an experience in the early 50s, a very troubled time for me. I spent that year abroad, having received a small grant. First part of it I spent in Italy, mostly in Florence, and then in Paris in the Montparnasse section. This is when my money was running out. I lived in a tiny family hotel, a walk-up hotel. I was on the fifth floor up. I remember walking those stairs. This was a hotel owned by a Vietnamese couple. And it was during this period that the happening in this poem struck me. It's called The Illumination. In that hotel, my life rolled in its socket, twisting my strings. All my mistakes from my earliest bedtimes rose against me. The parent I denied, the friends I failed, the hearts I spoiled, including at least my own left ventricle, a history of shame. Dante, I cried to the apparition entering from the hall, laureled and gaunt in a cone of light. Out of mercy you came to be my master and my guide. To which he replied, I know neither the time nor the way nor the number on the door. But this must be my room. I was here before. And he held up in his hand the key which blinded me. I say in one of my poems, we learn as the thread plays out, that we belong less to what flatters us than to what scars. This poem refers to an episode in my life that has left a permanent scar. It's called The Portrait. My mother never forgave my father for killing himself, especially at such an awkward time and in a public park that spring when I was waiting to be born. She locked his name in her deepest cabinet and would not let him out, though I could hear him thumping. When I came down from the attic with the pastel portrait in my hand of a long-lipped stranger with a brave mustache and deep brown level eyes, She ripped it into shreds without a single word and slapped me hard. In my 64th year, I can feel my cheek still burning. I was raised in a household of women, my mother and two older sisters. Both of them married, produced children, and died young. My sisters. Who whispered, souls have shapes? So has the wind, I say. But I don't know. I only feel things blow. I had two sisters once with long black hair who walked apart from me and wrote the history of tears. Their stories faded with their names, but the candlelight they carried, like dancers in a dream, still flickers on their gowns as they bent over me to comfort my night fears. Let nothing grieve you, Sarah and Sophia. Shush, shush, my dears, now and forever. I'll read the note to my next poem before I read the poem itself. When I was a boy in Worcester, Massachusetts, my family lived on top of a hill at the thin edge of the city with the woods beyond. Much of the time I was alone, but I learned how not to be lonely, exploring the surrounding fields and the old Indian trails. In the games that I improvised, most of them involved with running, climbing, and a variety of ball skills, I was a fierce competitor, representing in turn myself and my imaginary opponent. It did not occur to me to be surprised that I was always the winner. The stone throwing that figures in the poem was of a somewhat special order. Since it did more than try my skill, it challenged destiny. My life hinged on the three throws permitted me according to my rules. If I hit the target oak once, somebody would love me. If I hit it twice, I should be a poet. If I scored all three times, I should never die. A friend of mine tells me that what I have recorded here is recognizable as an ancient ritual, and that the patriarchal scarred oak, as I have described it, is transparently a manifestation of the king of the wood. Such mysteries for a Worcester childhood. the testing tree. Oh, one thing more I want to tell you about this poem. The concluding passage of this poem was written right after I heard on the radio about the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I feel it could have been written just the other day in this time of mourning. When I look behind, as I am compelled to look, before I can gather strength to proceed on my journey, I see the milestones dwindling toward the horizon and the slow fires trailing from the abandoned campsites over which scavenger angels wheel on heavy wings. Oh, I have made myself a tribe out of my true affections, and my tribe is scattered. How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses? In a rising wind, the manic dust of my friends, those who fell along the way, bitterly stings my face. Yet I turn, exulting somewhat, with my will intact to go wherever I need to go, and every stone on the road precious to me. In my darkest night, when the moon was covered, and I roamed through wreckage, a nimbus clouded voice directed me, "Live in the layers, not on the litter." Though I lack the art to decipher it, no doubt the next chapter in my book of transformations is already written. I am not done with my changes. The abduction. I know what triggered this poem. It was my reading of a book on UFO abductions entitled Missing Time. But this is not a poem about UFO abductions. Some things I do not profess to understand, perhaps not wanting to, including whatever it was they did with you or you with them, that timeless summer day when you stumbled out of the wood distracted, with your white blouse torn and a blood stain on your skirt. "Do you believe?" you asked. Between us, through the years, from bits, from broken clues, we pieced enough together to make the story real. How you encountered on the path a pack of sleek greyhounds, trailed by a dumb show retinue in leather shrouds, and how you were led through leafy ways into the presence of a royal stag, flaming in his chestnut coat, who kneeled on a swale of moss before you, and how you were borne aloft in triumph through the green, stretched on his rack of budding horn, till suddenly you found yourself alone in a trampled clearing. That was a long time ago, almost another age. But even now, when I hold you in my arms, I wonder where you are. Sometimes I wake to hear the engines of the night throbbing outside the East Bay window on the lawn spreading to the rose garden. You lie beside me in elegant repose, a hint of transport hovering on your lips, indifferent to the harsh green flares that swivel through the room, searchlights controlled by unseen hands. Out there is childhood country, bleached faces peering in with coals for eyes. Our lives are spinning out from world to world. The shapes of things are shifting in the wind. What do we know beyond the rapture and the dread? Ever since we've been living on the Cape, we've been arguing with the raccoons as to who really owns the property. It's still an unresolved question. This is a journal of one of our summers of contention. Raccoon Journal. July 14. Raccoon, noun, from the American Indian Algonquian Arakunum. He scratches with the hands. New World Dictionary. July 17. They live promiscuously in the woods above the marsh, snuggling in hollow trees or rock-piled hillside dens from which they swagger in dead of night, nosy, precocious, bushy-tailed, to inspect their properties in town. At every house they drop a calling card, doorstep deposits of soft reddish scats and heavy sprays of territorial scent that on damp mornings mixes with the dew. August 21-26. I've seen them under the street light, paddling up the lane, five pelts in single file, halting in unison to topple a garbage can and gorge on lobster shells and fish heads or scattered parts of chicken. Last year, my neighbor's dog, a full-grown Labrador retriever, chased a grisly old codger into the tidal basin, where shaggy arms reached up from the ooze to embrace him, dragging his muzzle under until at length he drowned. There's nobody left this side of Gull Hill to tangle with them. Certainly not my superannuated cat, domesticated out of nature, who stretches by the stove and puts on a show of bristling. She does that even when mice go racing around the kitchen. We seem to be two of a kind, though that's not to say I'm happy paying my vegetable tithes over and over out of ripe summer's bounty to feed omnivorous appetites, or listening to the scratch of prowlers from the fragrant terraces as they dig, dig, dig because they're mad for bone meal, uprooting plants and bulbs, whole clumps squirming and dank wherever they catch a whiff of buried angel dust. October 31, that's Halloween, to be like Orpheus, who could talk with animals in their own language. In sleep I had that art, but now I've waked into the separate wilderness of age, where the old libidinous beasts assume familiar shapes, pretending to be tamed. Raccoons, I can hear them confabulating on the porch, half chirring, half growling, bubbling to a manic hoot that curdles the night air. Something out there appalls. On the back door screen, a heavy fur piece hangs, spread-eagled, breathing hard, hooked by prehensile fingers, with its pointed snout pressing in, and the dark agates of its banded eyes furiously blazing. Behind, where shadows deepen, burly forms lumber from side to side like diminished bears in a flat-footed shuffle. They watch me unafraid. I know they'll never leave. They've come to take possession. Here's one of my garden poems. I call it The Round because it turns back at the end towards its beginning. The Round. Light splashed this morning on the shell-pink anemones, swaying on their tall stems. Down blue-spiked Veronica, light flowed in rivulets over the humps of the honeybees. This morning I saw light kiss the silk of the roses in their second flowering, my late bloomers, flushed with their brandy. A curious gladness shook me. So I have shut the doors of my house. So I have trudged downstairs to my cell. So I am sitting in semi-dark, hunched over my desk, with nothing for a view to tempt me but a bloated compost heap, steamy old stink pile under my window. And I pick my notebook up, and I start to read aloud the still wet words I scribbled on the blotted page. Light splashed. I can scarcely wait till tomorrow, when a new life begins for me, as it does each day, as it does each day. Here's the poem from which I take the title of my new collection. It's called Passing Through. And it was written on one of my late birthdays. Nobody in the widow's household ever celebrated anniversaries. In the secrecy of my room, I would not admit I cared that my friends were given parties. Before I left town for school, my birthday went up in smoke in a fire at City Hall that gutted the Department of Vital Statistics. If it weren't for a census report of a 5-year-old white male sharing my mother's address at the Green Street tenement in Worcester, I'd have no documentary proof that I exist. You are the first, my dear, to bully me into these festive occasions. Sometimes, you say, I wear an abstracted look that drives you up the wall, as though it signified distress or disaffection. Don't take it so to heart. Maybe I enjoy not being as much as being who I am. Maybe it's time for me to practice growing old. The way I look at it, I'm passing through a phase. Gradually, I'm changing to a word. Whatever you choose to claim of me is always yours. Nothing is truly mine except my name. I only borrowed this dust. The house I lived in Worcester, Massachusetts, from my 8th year on and through my adolescence, is now occupied by a young couple who have sort of adopted me. And who say my ghost walks through their house, our house, as I like to think of it. In my introductory remarks, I told of returning just a few days ago to that house. Every year, they send me a box of pears from the tree that my mother and I planted behind the house. This poem is entitled My Mother's Pears. Plump, green gold, Worcester's pride, transported through autumn skies in a box marked Handle with Care, sleep 18 Bartlett pears, hand-picked and polished and packed for deposit at my door, each in its crinkled nest with a stub of stem attached and a single bright leaf like a flag. A smaller than usual crop, but still enough to share with me, as always at harvest time. Those strangers are my friends, whose kindness blesses the house my mother built at the edge of town, beyond the last trolley stop, when the century was young, and she proposed for her children's sake to marry again, not knowing how soon the windows would grow dark and the velvet drapes come down. Rubble accumulates in the yard. Workmen are hammering on the roof. I am standing knee-deep in dirt with a shovel in my hand. Mother has wrapped a kerchief round her head. Her glasses glint in the sun. When my sisters appear at the scene, gangly and softly tittering, she waves them back into the house to fetch us pails of water, and they skip out of our sight in their matching midi blouses. I summon up all my strength to set the pear tree in the ground, unwinding its burlap shroud. It is taller than I. Make room for the roots, my mother cries. Dig the hole deeper. I'm coming now to the very last poems of my book and of this reading. This one has a Chicago, very local connection. It derives from a painting by my old and now lost friend, Philip Guston. And in it, I've incorporated memories of Philip and of our post-midnight conversations. The painting is a brutal one, and I can tell you that when I woke up, at least my wife, around 3 or 4 one morning and read her this poem that I'd just written, she said, "This is a really ugly poem." But she said it admiringly, so I forgave her. The sea that has no ending has an epigraph, which I'll read to you. Green Sea is one of a series of paintings Philip Guston did in 1976, featuring a tangle of disembodied legs, bent at the knees, and wearing flat, ungainly shoes, grouped on the horizon of a deep green sea against a salmon-colored backdrop. Its meaning eludes us. Descriptive note, master paintings in the Art Institute of Chicago. I hope you'll look at that painting. Who are we? Why are we here? Huddled on this desolate shore, so curiously chopped and joined, broken totems, a scruffy tribe. How many years have passed since beyond keys to a door, had friends, walked down familiar streets, an answer to a name. We try not to remember the places where we left pieces of ourselves along the way, whether in ditches at the side of foreign roads or under signs that spell for hire or naked between the sheets in cheap motels. Does anybody care? All the villagers have fled from the sorry sight of us. In the beginning, we had faith that the master who day and night lets nothing escape the glare from his invisible tower would soften at our appeals. But we are baffled by his replies, even more than by his silences. When we complain of the cruel sun and the blisters popping in our skin, he turns our suffering against us. A great wound, one you could claim your very own, might have saved you. Instead, you let others do you in with their small knives. What is to become of us? The sea that has no ending is lapping at our feet. How we long for the cleansing waters to rise and cover us forever. But he who reads our secret thoughts rebukes us, saying, "You cannot hope to be restored unless you dare to plunge head down into the mystery and there confront the beasts that prowl on the ocean floor." Sacred monsters is what he calls them. If only we had strength enough or nerve for a grand heroic action. Habit has made it easier for us to wait for the blessing of the tide. It's really strange how much we miss those people who came to gape and jeer. We'd welcome their return for company. Why is the master knocking at our ears, demanding immediate attention? In the acid of his voice, we sense the horns swelling at his temples and little drops of spittle bubbling at the corners of his mouth. "This is not an exhibition," he storms. "It's a life.